Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. At any given time, anywhere from a little over 100 to over 250 people are being held in the David L. Moss Criminal Justice Center as immigrant detainees for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement through the 287G program and as an ICE contract facility. Some are immigrants seeking asylum. Others have been accused of crimes, some minor, some more serious. Some are documented. Most are undocumented. But however they arrive at the county jail, when they come to the jail, they enter a sort of legal limbo state where state law, federal law, and immigration law collide and intersect. For the past several years, the clinical law program at the University of Tulsa and its Tulsa Immigrant Resource Network have been providing legal services to the detainees, with a mix of law students, young lawyers, and my guest today, Mimi Martin, the Director of Clinical Programs at the University of Tulsa College of Law and the Director of the Tulsa Immigrant Resource Network, and Robin Sherman, who is a clinical instructor. They describe their work today providing a voice to the voiceless. Mimi and Robin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Through the past summer and over the last year or so, your clinic has been providing legal help for the detainees housed at the Tulsa County Jail through the 287G program. Can you give us a sense of some of the people that are being held and some of the people you're trying to help?
Sure. There are actually, the 287G is a contract between ICE and Tulsa County. And that contract allows for Tulsa County Sheriff's officers to be deputized to enforce immigration law. So that's one contract. And people who come in through that program are more likely to be local folks who may be brought in for a variety of reasons. And that can range really from some pretty serious crimes to traffic violations, not including DUI. And the other thing to keep in mind that's real important is when I say serious criminal charges, is that if they're arrested on a charge, it's very different than being convicted of that charge, right? So somebody who is arrested for drug trafficking may be completely innocent of and acquitted eventually of those charges. So even when we look at the population that's in there and the criminal charges, it's easy to say, wow, these are bad people by looking at just the charges. But we've seen some extraordinary cases in which those charges are completely dismissed for one reason or another. And so it becomes really hard to say, you can't make a statement saying that everybody who's in there is just a bad person or just has committed a serious crime, because that just isn't an accurate statement.
So that's one program. And I guess there's another set of detainees that are being held that are being brought here from other places.
Right. So the second contract is called an intergovernmental service agreement. And so that contract essentially allows the Tulsa County Jail to be an ICE detention facility. So the people are detained there in two ways. One, they come through the 287G program, and once they're released from county custody, they are switched over to ICE detention. So they stay in the same facility. It's just formality of who actually has custody. And then that contract also allows individuals to be brought up from the border, from other detention facilities, individuals being transferred from other federal prisons to be detained in Tulsa as federal ICE detainees.
People who are accused of a crime.
Right.
Does this process, the way it's unfolding here at David L. Moss, does it mean that those people will not really face charges for the things they're accused of because this deportation for proceeding takes precedence?
No. So that's what's so interesting. So a couple things that other pieces of this puzzle to understand how it all works together. One, so if I am a foreign-born person, when I am brought into the jail, I am automatically subjected to an ICE screening, immigration screening, that tells them whether or not I have some kind of status here. Am I here authorized or am I here undocumented, right? And the next thing that's going to happen is that ICE is going to put what's called an ICE hold on me. And all that is a professional-to-professional courtesy. So it tells the sheriff, please don't release Mimi Martin without notifying us first because we may want her, right? That's all it is an ICE hold. But there is a tradition in Tulsa County that no one on an ICE hold is given bail or bond. So unlike if you were arrested as a U.S. citizen, you're going to probably get bail or bond, you know, depending on the crime that you did, but for fairly common conduct. And so you're going to get out. Right?
What about somebody here on a green card, permanent residence?
So it depends, right? So it depends on the nature of the charges for somebody on a green card. But most likely, ICE is still going to say, I want to hold on that person because depending on what pans out, there are certain charges that can lead even someone with a green card to be deported. So a green card is not a defense against certain crimes for deportation, right? So most likely ICE is going to put a hold on anyone who's not a U.S. citizen. Yeah. And so that means I'm not going to get out and I'm going to be in county custody until such time as my state charges are disposed of, at which point, as Robin pointed out, then ICE is most likely going to take custody of me. And I've now switched programs in terms of who's keeping me. But traditionally, let's say I'm convicted of some charge. What usually happens is, and what has been the norm and still is going on, is I will serve whatever jail time I get. And then I'm brought back into ICE custody for immigration proceedings. So I'm still paying my debt to society here, whatever that debt is, just like anybody else. And then the proceedings continue once I'm done paying that, serving that time.
But you also said you've seen some cases where the charges
right.
being preferred are, there may be very little reason.
Exactly.
And so tell me about that.
So we've seen a couple where there was one I can think of in particular that comes to mind. There were some pretty serious drug trafficking charges. And 10 months later?
12 months.
12 months
that
later?
That was an entire year.
The DA decided that this person was completely innocent. And they were dismissed, not for lack of evidence or not because there was some deal made, but in the interest of justice. And yet this person had sat in jail for a year and was then turned over to ICE custody. So we've also seen, so we go observe immigration court on a regular basis, and in particular with their students at least once a semester, if not more. And we regularly see people up on charges who were arrested for serious charges where the charges were just dismissed. So sometimes we see them because somebody is deemed innocent. Other times we don't know why they're dismissed. But the thing that happens is that if my charges are dismissed and I haven't been released and I'm just turned over to ICE custody, that means that from the beginning, I have very little chance of ever getting out. Most likely, I'm just going to be removed from the United States. And that may be because I've been a David Omoss on traffic violations or on serious charges or on charges that were dismissed or pled down, right? So, but unless I belong to a very slim group that is entitled to stay in the United States, most likely I'm going to end up being removed. And the issues are people often say, well, why don't you do it right? Why don't you get in line? Why don't you, you know, do things the right way? And the reality is there is no line to get into. And who can legally immigrate to the United States is a very small, narrow group. And so that's a major problem. So when people talk about immigration reform, I guess some people might like if you keep everybody out, but that's part of what we're seeing happening.
But it's also important to realize and recognize that there are individuals who have done it the quote-unquote right way who are caught up in the system. So individuals who have come here on student visas, for example, who are picked up on charges that are later dropped, so there's no foundation for those charges, then they're already caught up in that system and they'll lose the benefits of that student visa and then be deported. So they technically did it the right way, but they're still suffering the consequences of these contractual relationships here in Tulsa.
And can you get to the heart of that idea that you could be picked up on a charge, never actually, that charge is never prosecuted, but you're in the same boat? I mean, you know, of being possible deported if you're on a student visa or you're on some, you know, extended visa to the United States. Maybe you have one of the working visas. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what that means, you know, for the system.
So for example, if someone's here on a student visa and they are picked up for a charge that, you know, eventually they will not be convicted of, some charge that there's no foundation for, they were falsely accused, whatever the situation may be. So once they get into the system, because what Mimi was talking about, where these contracts with Tulsa County doesn't allow these individuals to get bond, they will have to sit in jail for the entire time that these charges are being worked out in the court. So that can be, you know, a year, it could be months, it could be a year. And we've seen individuals like Mimi just mentioned where they sit in jail for a year. And what that means is there's all these consequences that spring from that for that individual. So if they're on a student visa and they can't go to school because they're being detained, then they have violated their student visa. So by the time they actually get those criminal charges disposed of and they're in ICE custody, well, they no longer have status and they're going to be deported. So that's what it means for them. So even if it's a charge that they're not convicted of, they've now paid more consequences than they deserve or more consequences than anyone else would pay who is a U.S. citizen.
Right. And so they're going to lose their student visa. The other thing that we have seen, and we've seen mostly single moms, but it was just reported to us there's a single dad and they're going through the same thing. And that is that if you're in jail all of this time and you're a single parent, where are your kids? And they're most likely in foster care. And we have seen terrible situations where, you know, juvenile court, the DA starts deprive proceedings, which are the proceedings to terminate someone's parental rights. And the person is in jail on an ice hold, and they weren't ever neglectful, abusive, or abandoning of their children ever. The issue is they're in jail, and they can't get bail like I would get as a U.S. citizen. And so the kids go into foster care, the proceedings are started, and we have numerous cases where the parent is not transported to the hearing at juvenile court. So talk about no due process. We have also had a couple cases where that person didn't even have an attorney appointed. So nobody in that hearing was representing this parent. And maybe the parent is a really bad person. You know, I mean, maybe they are. That's not what we've seen, though. In most cases, we've just seen ordinary folks who aren't able to be at the hearing in which it's going to be determined whether or not their parental rights are terminated.
So before we get to that other question, mm-hmm. tell us about the actual sort of, what sort of due process is in place for these detainees here in Tulsa?
Right. So this is one giant problem of not being transported, and the cost of this is losing your rights to your children. And in some of the cases we've seen where there are extended incarceration periods, many times the parent has gone without seeing the child for that entire time. That's happened in numerous cases. So that's one, is if there's a hearing going on in which I have certain rights, then the basic, you know, due process 101 is that I get notice of this hearing and I'm allowed to be at the hearing to defend myself, right? So that's one. The second one that we see that's really tangled up in this issue of if we didn't detain people, people wouldn't show up to court, which is proven statistically to be not true.
Right.
But is we've gone through this period of time in the past where the notices of hearing that were given to detainees had fake dates on them.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
ICE actually admitted that to us. An ICE attorney said, yeah, that's what we're doing to you know, make sure we have a date on there, because there was a case that came out that said if there's no date, then in certain circumstances, that's not due process, right? Because, again, it's not notice. If you don't
know. So it's not necessarily a fake date, but they're putting they're making a date up.
Blatantly fake dates. Yeah. Like okay. One of them said 12 a.m. as their hearing
there
time.
There was no midnight court.
So
we
were all just like, is there a new midnight docket that we don't know about? Right. Just trying to figure out when their actual court dates was. But it was a way to try to get around this new court ruling that.
Yeah. And so obviously it didn't work.
Yeah.
And they did, we think they've stopped doing it, but it's not unusual for somebody. Well, first of all, everything they're served is in English. It's very complicated, and it gets confusing to us, and we speak the language and we're lawyers, right? To a layperson who doesn't speak the language, this system has got to look like insanity personified. And so they might leave with instructions that talk about what your responsibilities are to different arms of the immigration world. So, for example, one arm is the court, and you have to show up in court, but we'll tell you when at a later date, okay? Another arm is you have to show up to check in with ICE, which is part of the immigration court, the attorneys, ICE attorneys show up in immigration court. And so people have said to us, well, I checked in with ICE, I'm done. Well, did you show up to court? No. Okay, well, if you had a court date and you didn't show up, you're ordered removed. But if the person thinks that I went to immigration, right, because I went and checked in with ICE in Dallas or in Oklahoma City, that's another very confusing but understandable issue. I checked in with immigration. What more am I supposed to do? And by the way, immigration has my address. Well, did you give the address to the court? I don't know. I gave it to immigration.
So,
did you do two address changes, right? And so who thinks like that, right? Like,
so
normal,
like,
people don't think like that.
Multiple hoops to jump
multiple
through.
Hoops. And you miss one hoop, that's it. You're out and you're labeled as a bad person, a bad immigrant, someone who doesn't show up, doesn't obey our laws. So that's another piece that we've seen.
And it's never explained to these individuals. So there's no one who stops unless an attorney goes in to do a consultation that says this is exactly how it works. And from the very beginning, it's very adversarial to these individuals, whether they're asylum seekers or undocumented individuals or individuals seeking certain types of status. It's never explained.
Right.
My guests today are Mimi Martin, the director of the clinical programs at the University of Tulsa College of Law, and Robin Sherman, who is a clinical instructor. Both have been participating in the Tulsa Immigrant Resource Network. They've been working with populations at David L. Moss who are being detained through the 287G program and the intergovernmental contract facility that David L. Moss is for detainees, not only here in our community and around northeastern Oklahoma, but other parts of the U.S. and the border. Let me ask you, how many are being actually held in Tulsa? Do we have a good number?
So the number usually ranges. Sometimes we go as low as 100. At one point in May of 2018, we were up to close to 300. So it depends on what's going on. At the border, it depends on what kind of arrests are taking place in Tulsa and what sort of folks are being transferred to Tulsa from other areas of the country. There's a wide variation, and we never quite know who's there really until we get in there.
Is it, again, people accused of a crime? Do we have what we would call dreamers?
Absolutely. And when we first started going in, we saw, again, when we talk about due process. So dreamers right now are only eligible for a program called DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Deferred action is a long tradition in the immigration world, and it really only is a promise from the government to not deport you based on actions that you've taken up until that point. It's not status, it's not a visa, it's not a green card, it's just a promise and a work authorization. And it's a discretionary form of relief, which many forms of immigration are. And so what they were doing is as soon as a DACA kid was accused of a crime, they were stripping them of DACA, even if, regardless of what happened to those charges, right? And so when we first started going in, we saw several DACA kids who were stripped of their DACA, and then the criminal charges were dismissed, but they were deported because they had no other eligibility for anything. I mean, you wouldn't be a DACA if you were eligible for a green card, right? It's just not worth it. And then the ACLU stepped in nationally and sued and said, you can't do that. That's not due process. You can't strip something away from somebody based on charges, because a charge is just a charge, and it's not a conviction. And so we were involved in one case where actually Robin got somebody's DACA reinstated because the charge had never been disposed of yet.
And you'd be talking in a situation that where a person that came here in early childhood, the United States, for all intents and purposes, is their home.
That's right.
And they're going to be deported to a country that's probably completely unknown because you don't go and visit it because you will not come back.
Exactly.
Right. That's exactly. We've seen people, they weren't DACA recipients because for one reason or another, they couldn't qualify for DACA. There's lots of really specific ways you have to qualify for DACA, not criminal related, but they were picked up on a charge, and the charge is nothing worse that, you know, many teenagers are picked up for. It was not a felony. It was nothing bad. And this individual was deported to a country that they hadn't been to since they were 2 months old. So a lot of times when these individuals get picked up, again, because of these contracts that Tulsa County has with ICE, they get caught up in this system that they can't get out of, and then they suffer these really extreme consequences for the only reason that they were brought over here when they were a child. They had no choice in it. So they didn't make any decision that caused this to happen. It's just the state of our immigration system.
You and your students that are helping the detainees with whatever legal programs you can, I was really struck by something that I think one of the persons came up with, and it goes to the coercive nature of incarceration for these detainees in appealing a deportation notice or, you know, if whatever steps they have remaining to them. And many of them would just say, yeah, just go ahead and send me back. I'm tired of sitting in this jail. How often have you run into a situation like that?
That's probably one of the more common situations we run into, because especially if these individuals are caught up in the 287G program, they've already spent too long in jail for a charge that someone wouldn't spend that long in if they were a U.S. citizen. And then they're turned over to the immigration system, which sometimes works really fast and sometimes works really slow. Mm-hmm. And it's really abusive in a lot of ways. They're placed in a jail for an immigration hold, so it's not a criminal issue at that point. It's a civil violation. And yet they're still being held in a jail and treated just like everyone else who's in the Tulsa County jail who is in there for more serious crimes. And then going through the immigration system where from day one, when you step into the court, it's adversarial. It's like being prosecuted. There's an ICE attorney who sits on the other side of the room who's essentially a prosecutor in a lot of ways and is arguing against you no matter what. There's never an instance where the ICE attorney says, you know what, I think you have a good case. I agree with this. That rarely, rarely, rarely happens. I don't want to say never, but rarely.
Rarely.
And it's exhausting, and it wears these individuals down, and they get to a point where even going back to countries where their life is clearly in danger, that's better than suffering through what they have to hear.
And it's most stark, I think, when we talk about asylum seekers, right? Because they arrive sort of stunned. How did I get into a jail? Where's Tulsa, Oklahoma? I don't know where I am. I have no family here. I have no relationship to Tulsa. This is just where ICE sent me.
Not to mention just the journey to get to the border.
The journey to
and present
get to
themselves
the border. Exactly.
Is harrowing.
Well, and the journey is so dangerous. And there's no question that by the time they arrive, they're freezing, they're starving, they're traumatized. They may have been attacked on the way in. We've had stories where people are kidnapped right at the border and have to pay ransom in order to get family members free. So it's a nightmare. And the issue of, you know, there's two questions that are always asked. You know, one side is, well, why would you put your kids through that? Why would you put yourself through that? And the response is, imagine how bad it must be where I come from if I have to pack my bags and do that, right? And
right.
So that is really what is failing in the political rhetoric today is imagine what would cause you to do that.
What would cause you to leave the United States?
Exactly.
Would it be? You would not take that decision lightly.
And our, you know, especially because so many people are from Central America, we have an expert on that region of the world. And he's an ex-police officer. Let's give him some credibility. So it's not like he's like me, some bleeding heart liberal. He's an ex-police officer. And he testifies in court. Look at the three Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, are essentially run by the gangs, by these criminal organizations. There's so much corruption from the top to the bottom. We've had people tell us that, you know, why didn't you call the police? What police? The police ran away from my village and left us because the gangs were so bad they were in danger. So that's the kind of world in which they live. I can't send my kids to school because the gangs recruit on the way to and from school. So these are countries that are being run by, you know, maybe most Americans can relate more to ISIS. Imagine an ISIS country. And that's what this is.
Criminal cartels.
A criminal cartel. They run the countries. There's no functioning government to speak of. And so when we talk about why are you coming to the United States, that's the wrong question. The question is, why did you have to leave your country and go through this harrowing journey? Even if you knew that right now what's going to happen to you at the border is even worse. But I think what they're usually not expecting is to be put in jail. Right. And the way that David Almas is structured is absolutely a jail, down to the idea of if we want to see somebody in an attorney room where it's private, they are chained to the wall. And again, you're a torture survivor by definition if you're an asylum seeker, right? Or you have a fear of some kind of future torture. And really, clients have said to us, I have been tortured again by being in this system. And then they get in front of this judge who... Our judges are very harsh here. We have about a 17% at best grant rate in asylum cases with our judges, so it's super low. And after a while, I begin to wonder, you know, I've had clients say to me, if I knew what I was going to go through, I never would have even started this. And imagine that. So you can go live in this country where you might die, or you can go through our system, and they're beginning to wonder which one is a better choice.
So 17%.
17%, and that's being very generous, I have to say. We have six judges right
now. Do we have a sense of what qualifies for asylum in this particular jurisdiction? And I imagine it would be very different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
It is very different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, although about a year and a half ago, maybe a little bit longer, one of the asylum experts in the country made a statement, wrote an article about what does qualify for asylum anymore. So it's and she has been practicing for about four decades. So it's confusing, it's convoluted, it's politicized, it's an administrative law where some people have way too much power. So right now, it is completely lawful for the attorney general, him or herself, to say, I don't like the way someone decided that case, I'm going to take it back and reverse it. And that has happened more times under the Trump administration than ever before. And in some cases, they are overturning decades of litigation.
You know, back in the old days of asylum, when I was growing up, I mean, it was like the United States had favored nations and unfavored nations. And if you came from an unfavored nation, you had a pretty good chance of getting asylum, simply based on the political situation between the United States and that country. Is that still the case today? Say, if I'm coming from Venezuela, which is, you know, we don't have a good relationship from Venezuela. Do I have a better chance than if I come from the Central Triangle or from Central America, any part of Central America?
Yeah. I used to think there were cases that had better chances. And a colleague from a different part of the country might be able to still answer that by saying yes. In our part of the country, I'm having trouble imagining what that 17% represents, which is why I feel it's generous, because it doesn't seem to matter anymore what country. And part of what has changed is, you know, we're not seeing waves of defectors from the Soviet Union, right? So that was one of the big ones. And in the last administration, the relationship with Cuba was, you know, they were trying to repair it. So some of those special situations have gone away. So that's a piece of it. But I will have to say that when in the past, outside of our judges here, when I've argued about someone who I know, when I can pin my coattail on an issue I know that the U.S. is particularly hot about, then yes, it's definitely easier to say, you know, look at, I was a Christian in an entirely XYZ faith country, and I was persecuted. We always felt like that had a better chance. But it's also a little hard to weigh and measure because I practice in areas that didn't have only a 17% grant rate, right? So what comprises that 17%? They seem anxious to deny as many times as possible.
So have you run across clients that have good cases for staying in the United States and have been successful?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, well, successful. The first part of your question, yes. We've certainly had a lot of clients who we think, wow, this is an amazing case, but we always hesitate in bringing that case here in the Dallas court because it's such a low grant rate. And our experience in the court has been that it's not, the law is not always applied correctly. And it's always applied in the harshest manner to clients.
You mentioned Dallas. Do the cases take place in Dallas for the ones here in Oklahoma?
Right. So we don't have an immigration court here.
Okay.
We're under the jurisdiction of the Dallas Immigration Court. And that changes a couple of things for us, too. So if you were to bring a lawsuit against me in Tulsa, Oklahoma for something other than immigration, and it was a federal case, we would be in what's called the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals jurisdiction, right? In immigration, because we're Dallas, we get into the Fifth Circuit. So
those are
completely different
court of appeals.
You know, and the 10th is much more neutral. It's not always great, but it's not always awful, right? It's just sort of in the middle. The Fifth Circuit is one of the most, if not the most, conservative in the nation. And when I taught in Connecticut in the Second Circuit, we would come up with these Fifth Circuit cases and honestly put them aside because they didn't make any sense. It's like, you didn't get the law right. And so now having to practice under those cases is extraordinarily challenging. And they are rarely immigrant friendly, and sometimes they pretzel themselves such that they don't have to be. So it's really many whammies for our clients who are here, often because they like it here, their family's here, but whatever case we have, even outside of asylum, is always going to be more difficult in front of our judges.
And that's the other piece. Like, it's challenging for us from a legal perspective as attorneys, but it is life-altering for our clients because so many individuals that we have, we know they will die if they return to their home country. So it becomes really complicated as a lawyer to weigh how you're going to move forward with a case when you know their chances of succeeding are very, very low.
And when they're sitting in confinement, incarcerated, and they say, yeah, just go ahead and send me back.
Well, see, that now we're full circle, right, mm-hmm. to your discussion with Robin earlier, and that it's often the case, even with someone from the border, that we walk in and we are just swarmed with desperate detainees saying, I've been here for 3 months, I'm from the border, nobody's had any conversation with me at all. It's like, what do you mean no one? Like, no officer, nobody knows anything about my case. I filed this, I filed that, or I think I filed this or that, and no one has said a word to me. And some of that is a function of what's happening now is a little bit like if you had a clogged drain and you decided the best cure would be to pull out more hair and put more hair down the drain. That's sort of what's happening.
Pour
now.
More water in the sink.
Or pour more water, you know, instead of calling a plumber and digging it all out and looking at it, right? And so the immigration system was backed up and dysfunctional way before the 2016 elections. But the only thing that's happened since then is shoving more hair in the drain.
Mimi and Robin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mimi Martin is the Director of Clinical Programs at the University of Tulsa College of Law, and Robin Sherman is a clinical instructor. They are both also with the Tulsa Immigrant Resource Network, working on behalf of detainees at the county jail. For information on the program, visit utulsa.edu/legal-clinics. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.